Endeavor. So that's good. And yeah, I think it's toward the end of October they'll be going up again to the International Space Station to continue filling the scientific lab bigger than ever. This mission, they're going to disconnect the solar panel, the main solar panel. It's been up there essentially from the beginning. When they started living there permanently, they put one large panel for the C6 truss and solar panel up there, and that's been operating for years. Subsequently, they've added these other panels to the starboard side and the port side. Well, they're going to now switch this thing over to the end of the port side, and eventually bring up another panel for the starboard side. So you'll eventually have four gigantic sets of solar panels, 240 feet long by 40 feet each. But it's pretty huge, and we'll be able to have enough power to supply and keep people on board for 7 days. So I'm sure that mission's going to be quite involved, just trying to move that thing. That's the main focus, and there's always other things that they're doing as well. Always resupplying the space station, getting rid of garbage that's on the space station. I'm talking about 1,000, 5,000 pounds of stuff, you know, each time they do that type of thing. Reboosting the space station, goes on and on. And, yeah, STS-120, notice that there seems to be a 119 missing, STS-119. That was absorbed, like, between the 18 and 20 flights. When they laid these missions out years ago, years into the future, sometimes they're able to consolidate work. I think that's what happened to 119. Yes, about the Hubble repair mission, that's scheduled for 125. So they have a crew, they're training, and eventually they plan on doing that to service the Hubble, keep that on the loft for maybe another half a dozen years, hopefully. Let's see, if it's one another half a dozen years, let's say that would get you to 2000 and 10, 12, something like that. If they can get to 2013, that would be good, because that's the scheduled launch of the James Webb telescope. That's the one that's going to be put out at the Lagrange 3, I think it is. Lagrange 2, I forget which one that is. It's 1 million miles out, in any sense. It's away from Earth. In other words, you'll have the Sun, Earth, and then the spacecraft 1 million miles out, permanently sitting there, not orbiting really Earth, just sitting there, following or actually orbiting the Sun. So this million mile away spacecraft will eventually have to do things automatically, not to mention maneuver, but, you know, and communicate, but the mirrors on board, it's not one big gigantic mirror like they had in the Hubble Space Telescope, 14 foot diameter mirror that the Hubble has. This thing has 18 individual mirrors. Actually, has 19. You know, one is acting like a reflector, but 18 essential mirrors that all have to be adjusted. And this thing's going to be big. It's going to be, you know, like 21 feet diameter, and compared to the Hubble's 14, you know how many more square feet that would be. You can do the math on that. And it will see much further than Hubble ever did. And again, it will be launched in 2013. All these adjustable mirrors, they're using a technique that's been developed, and they tested it on a 4-foot diameter scale model last week, and apparently that worked. So that'll be a go for not too far away future for the James Webb Space Telescope there. Opportunity and Spirit are doing well up on Mars, coming up to 4 years. Opportunity going now into Victoria Crater. Both craft have been sitting pretty much idle because of the winter up there and the windstorms that they had. They were worried about all the dust that cut the power down tremendously, so they pretty much went into almost like a sleep mode for a couple of months. But now they're up and running. Some of the wind blew the dust off the panels like it did a few years ago, and they have enough power to continue their mission. So that's pretty good. And that's pretty much it, Dick, for now. SDS missions, the Hubble Space Telescope mission, Opportunity and Spirit, and of course the James Webb Telescope program. A couple of other things to watch at the end of the month. One main one I'm going to watch anyway is the launch of the Dawn spacecraft by the Delta II rocket assembly from Kennedy down in Florida on the 28th of this month, and that's going to go out to two asteroids, and that's the one with the three ion engines. That should be pretty good. Billions of miles away, using these ion engines to be continually operated. They're going to operate them. It's going to be roughly a 10-12 year mission. They're going to be operating maybe 5 or 6 solid years, in the on mode all those years. So that's pretty good. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N.
Boy, a lot of stuff going on there. Paul, thank you. Also glad to hear that Hubble on STS Space Transport System number 125 will be handled. The James Webb Telescope, I should know and I don't. What's the diameter of that one, Paul? Go ahead.
21 feet. Hubble is roughly 14, so I should do some quick math here. I figure out how much bigger that would be. That's about 14 feet. 18 separate mirrors, individually operated. It's a weird looking thing. Bring up James Webb telescope on it. Get a picture of this thing. What this thing's going to look like. Strange looking contraption that it's attached to, and then it is this big mirror with all these segmented pieces that are all supposed to operate together. You should bring that one up there when you get a chance.
W2TTT. Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, I just have a question about this telescope. I'm wondering if it goes into, shall we say, a stupid mode like the Hubble. Granted, it can't. It's, well, exactly the same way because the mirrors are much smaller. They're using a mirror complex to get the same effect. But let's say they have to go out there and physically tend to it. Is it going to be in a place where we can send a shuttle or a follow-on vehicle in order to do maintenance?
Yeah, good question, Gordon. The answer is no, no, no. Absolutely not. No way. Not a chance. Let me explain that. The whole reason you build a telescope as big as 21 feet in mirror diameter is to gather more light. People in the astronomy world will call a really big telescope a light bucket. Just to give you an example, the advanced telescope they've got at the European Southern Observatory in La Salina, Chile, on top of a mountain near La Salina, Chile, has two telescopes side by side. I'm not sure, but I think each one of them is something like 10 feet in diameter, and maybe 10 meters in diameter. Anyhow, they're huge telescopes, and just to prove the worth of that piece of hardware, they aimed it at Halley's Comet. You and I call it Halley's Comet. The astronomers call it Halley's Comet. The family pronounces the name Halley. Anyhow, that comet, which comes by once every 75 years or something like that. And the comet right now is at the maximum or very close to the maximum distance of its orbit from Earth. The aphelion. In other words, the furthest it gets from the Sun. Halley's Comet is considerably darker than a piece of coal. And out there where it goes, way beyond Pluto, the Sun, if you could see the Sun from there, it would look like just an ordinary star in the sky. You get no real light from it. So that dim an object that far away, when they aimed this advanced telescope from European Observatory, they were gathering something like one photon per 1.5 seconds. And they did this for a couple of days of integration. And they did do a picture, so to speak, of Halley's Comet. And that was magnitude 29, if I remember correctly. And so just to round things off incorrectly would be 10 to the minus 29 power, the amount of light you're getting compared to the sensitivity of your eyes, so to speak. Very, very dim picture. So the bigger the telescope, the more you can gather light. The bigger the telescope, the higher the resolution, the picture you get. By putting the James Webb Telescope out at the outer Lagrange point, which I think is Lagrange 3, but I'm also not sure, but it's the one that's a million miles away from Earth in the opposite direction from the Sun, whereas your SOHO satellite is a million miles away from the Sun, from the Earth, in the direction of the Sun. It's another quasi-stable position. So SOHO being a million miles from us in the direction of the Sun gives us forewarning that a whole bunch of solar wind and a solar prominence just occurred, and all this material is zooming toward us at literally a million miles an hour. And the satellite tells you it's on the way, get ready, and put your satellites in the safe mode and do whatever you have to do to protect your power systems on Earth and so on. By the same token, Hubble does a beautiful job, but it's in orbit around the Earth at 321 nautical miles. It goes around, I forget how many times per day, but it's continuously being cycled between cold and hot, because it keeps going on the back side of the Earth away from the Sun, and it gets super cold, and on the forward side of the Earth towards the Sun, where it gets considerably hotter. And some of the damage you experience with the Hubble that requires repair is being aggravated by that condition. By taking a really big telescope and putting out this outer Lagrange point, it's not in orbit with anything except the Sun. It happens to be tracking the Earth, but it's really in orbit around the Sun. And the Earth is just its station keeper. The gravity mass concentration of the Earth helps it stay in a known location. And so, being on the backside of the Sun, it's being shielded from the sunlight, and that's one of the things you've got to worry about. If Hubble, by mistake, ever aims that telescope toward the Sun, which gives it 1,300 watts per square meter, it would burn up just about everything in there of sensitivity, of value, so to speak. It would make it into a very useless piece of space junk if, by mistake, you ever aimed Hubble at the Sun. By putting the James Webb Telescope out there, you're not being thermally cycled. You have less chance of aiming it toward the Sun. It can do better work for a whole bunch of reasons. That's the good news. What scares me is that repair is out of the question. The Hubble, the highest it ever has been, is doing, I mean, the space shuttle, the highest ever been, is during a Hubble mission, 321 nautical miles. You read the Space Shuttle Operator's Handbook, of which I've got a copy, and it tells you that the very highest the shuttle can ever go is 600 nautical miles. Well, that's a little bit shy of the 1 million miles of that mission. Nothing has gone that far except Apollo, as far as manned missions are concerned. And so, could you make a robot that can remotely be controlled and do repair? That's possible, with difficulty. But to send a man there to do the repair, no way. Can't be done. Won't happen. And that scares me because, obvious by our experience with Hubble, gyros burn up. You come up with better technology, more sensitive receivers you can add to it, more sensitive detector systems, higher resolution detector systems, better compression techniques for sending the data down. There's continuous development going on in the world of astronomy, particularly when it comes to earthbound astronomy and it comes to adaptive optics that tries to take out the the interference taking place, the aberration caused by the atmosphere. We've all seen what the sun looks like when it shines through your backyard swimming pool and you see the shadows of the water going onto the bottom of the pool. Well, the Earth's atmosphere is doing the equivalent of that. That's the reason why stars twinkle at nighttime. So the atmosphere, to look through it with a Sirius telescope, represents a significant detriment to what kind of resolution you could be getting. Hubble being above the atmosphere has this huge advantage that it doesn't have to worry about the atmosphere. That's the good news. But the bad news is periodically needs repair. I hope that the James Webb telescope has all kinds of built-in tests, all kinds of built-in self-repair, redundancy, and ultimately I think there's going to have to be a remotely controlled robot, because I'm relatively sure you're going to do more serious repairs downrange, and you're going to want to do updating. Let me turn it over to Paul first for a comment I'm about, for a question I'm about to ask him, and I'll turn it back to you, Gordon, for further comments on your rather good question. Paul, is there still any talk about remote-controlled robots that can both repair the Hubble Space Telescope and possibly do maintenance on James Webb? Because although we've learned a lot with Hubble, I'm not convinced that something as complicated as the James Webb will be thoroughly happy without some form of repair capability. WS2N, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Well, if they ever do, it will have to be robotic, of course. But as far as the Hubble, they thought about that for a long time after Columbia, and many, probably millions of dollars research has gone into it. So, you know, for them to abandon that idea and altogether and go with a crewed space crew to do it, that tells me that they're still very far behind. Not out of the question, but I think so many years away, and I certainly probably beyond the year 2013 for the James Webb mission. If that thing gets in trouble in 2014, I think they're going to have big problems. You know, they have lucked out. The Chandra space telescope, now that thing is in an orbit, but it's like, I believe it's like a 10-to-1 ratio. You know, it's sometimes it's about 8,000 miles away from Earth, and then other times it's 80,000 miles away from Earth. So when that thing was launched by the space shuttle, they said this thing is not going to be serviceable ever. So let's make sure this thing works right, and I guess they'll have to follow that same mindset when they put this thing up there. Apollo, yeah, and they've gone to the moon. Maybe they could design the new Orion system that's eventually going to go to the moon and eventually to asteroids and eventually to the to Mars. Maybe they could design something around that platform to get out to the Lagrange point. I guess they'd have a chance with that. You got to remember, a million miles. Four times the distance away from the moon. Moon's a quarter of a million miles, so what, it takes 3-4 days to get there, 4, 8, 12, I don't know, 16 days just to get to just to get to this big thing, and then work on it another 16 days back in a little spacecraft. I don't think so. Back to you, Nick. WS.
So as you can see, Gordon, no way is there going to be repair. And can you make something that big, that elaborate, work so well that it requires no repair and no updating? In my mind, that's a very serious challenge. In the case of Hubble, we've spent a lot of money. We put forth a tremendous amount of effort to put that thing out there. And what has it done? Arguably, it is the most productive piece of space hardware NASA has ever created. By now, it's probably up to 500,000 very high resolution astronomical photographs with all kinds of studies. They must get a very large number of proposals for scope time, the telescope time, for various research endeavors going on at the various universities, various doctoral students, whatever, come up with research programs, submit a proposal to the Space Telescope Science Institute, and hopefully get approval and get some scope time for what the Space Telescope Science Institute, if I got the name right, what they did a couple of years ago is to declare some time for themselves. And they did the deep field and ultra deep field photograph. In the case of the ultra deep field photograph, they aimed Hubble in a direction that was normally dark, a little bit away from the Big Dipper. There's a very dark section of sky, which seems to contain no stars. But there was no evidence that there was a whole lot of dust in that direction. So it wasn't just that there's no stars because it's being obscured. It's just a section that locally looks blank. And they started asking themselves, is it really blank? So they aimed in that direction that looked dark, almost nothing there, for 1 million seconds, integrated that picture. And when you look at that picture, and I've got a copy of it, it's a mind blower. The picture contains 2,300 galaxies that have never been seen before. Each galaxy contains roughly 10 billion stars, 2,300 of them. And some of them have extremely large redshifts, record-breaking redshifts. In other words, how far away they are and the velocity at which they're moving away from us is breaking brand new records. When you do a study like that, you get a little bit more of a picture of how fantastic the universe is, how difficult it is to understand, and it sort of starts making us ask an awful lot of questions of what is our true origin, what's going to happen, how does it all happen, where are we alone, all these kinds of questions. And some of the two biggest haunting studies going on right now, I mean, real mind-blowing studies, are what really is creating the gamma ray bursts, and why is the material in every direction out of the perimeter of the observable universe, where the material out there should be slowing down and eventually stop and come back, and Big Bang be followed by a big crunch. Everybody was positive that's going to happen. So they do a bunch of measurements to find out how fast is the material out of the perimeter slowing down. And the answer is it's not slowing down, it's speeding up. The stuff out of the perimeter is moving away from us faster and faster. And so now they're looking for what they call dark energy, the repulsive force that takes the material only out at the perimeter and pushes on it and pushes away, whereas the stuff nearby is not pushing, being pushed away. And so they don't know what it is, but they've given it a name, dark energy. It's like calling it a virus. You don't know what it is, but you give it a name. And so every time I go to an astronomy meeting, I say to these guys, my private theory on this one, and I'm not alone. I say the material out of the perimeter is being sucked into the next universe. For us to sit here and think that this is the only possible universe there ever was, and there was never any other one, is very arrogant. We've already been humbled 4 or 5 times in a row. We used to think the Earth was the center of the universe. It's not. We used to think the Sun is the center of the solar system, and that was the center of the universe. It's not. We found out there's this island galaxy, this island universe, as we used to call it, called a galaxy. And so we thought we're in the center of that galaxy, and that's the center of the universe. It's not. And we're part of a local galactic group of 4 galaxies. And we thought that's all of it. It's not. And so when it comes to the whole universe, we thought we were in the center of it, and everything revolves around us. Well, dream on. We ain't quite that important. And so I think for the 4th or 5th time in a row, we're about to be humbled again and find out there are multiverses, multiple universes. And so the material out at the perimeter is sensing the gravity field of the next universe over the hill that we can't even see because it's so far away. Unless we build a bigger telescope and integrate for a longer period of time. So that and gamma ray burst, my goodness, is that a big bang? Just to give you a couple of seconds on that one, Gordon, if you like astronomy, and that is that the sun, because you and I can go out in the backyard and we can measure the fact that the sun is giving us 1,300 watts per square meter at high noon. We know exactly what the solar constant is, and it's been very constant for the last zillion years that we can measure it. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it appears to be extremely constant. You know the sun is 93 million miles away. You know how much energy you're getting. You can figure out how much energy it's putting out. I think it's 10 to the 27 joules. 10 to the 27 watts is coming out of the sun at that rate, joules per second. You know that the sun's been around for 5 billion years. you know it's going to last for a total of 10 billion. So we got 5 billion left. When you figure out how much energy comes out of the sun each second, and you figure out it's going to do it for a billion, 10 billion years, you can figure out the total energy output. And it's 10 to the 43 or 10 to the 44 joules is the total solar output. That's what the sun, a darn nice star with a beautiful nuclear furnace in the center, that's how much energy it's going to put out over a 10-year period of time. When a gamma ray burst occurs, and you get one of them every month or so, a really good-sized one, that you can detect with the Vela satellite, the gamma ray detecting satellite, among others, Velas among others, you get that amount of energy in the explosion in not 10 billion years. You get that energy in approximately 1 or 2 seconds. Is that a big bang?
Wow.
That's potent. If one of those occurs within 22 light years of where you and I live, we're gone. We're cooked. Game over. Thank goodness one of those hasn't occurred in the last 22 light years of us. We've had something like 4 or 5 mass extinctions on the Earth, and was it a gamma ray burst nearby that did it? Interesting question. So, as you can see, there's a few more things unknown compared to known in space, and hopefully the Webb Space Telescope is going to help. The Chandra, a beautiful X-ray telescope that's got this elaborate orbit with no repair capability, has been taking some X-ray pictures of the universe. You take a picture of the universe in far infrared, you get one chunk of information. Near infrared, you get another. Optical, you get another. Ultraviolet and X-ray, you get another. You get more and more information as you go across the whole spectrum. And you'd like to have telescopes from DC to cosmic ray, you know, the lowest possible frequency, the highest possible frequency, Jim. And so the James Webb is going to try to solve some of that. Not quite sure how I got into that particular tirade, but I'm back to you, Gordon. Maybe we've triggered a couple of questions. W2 triple tango, KQLAW in the tech man.
I've got a question, WHCDL mobile.
Andy, you recognize, but go ahead first. Go ahead, Gordon.
Oh, man. All right, because you have another question, I'm just going to hypothesize that the maintenance process, you talk about it being essentially robotic, which I think is probably sensible, but it could also involve, you know, having a vehicle go out, grab the sucker, bring it back into a nearer place, let's say within that 600-mile place, and then push it back out. You know, it doesn't take a lot of energy to do that, to be patient enough. And it doesn't require a particularly sophisticated vehicle to go do that if they made provisions for latching onto this vehicle. Again, I don't know about its geometry and such, and whether or not it can be safe. I'm sure at some level it can be safe for optical reasons, sensor reasons, but I'm wondering if it could be, you know, moved a million miles, maintained, and then pushed back out again. That would probably be something that would be really interesting. As far as mass extinctions go, I'm thinking that, gamma rays are probably responsible for some of that. Although I think, you know, blood poison trauma from other celestial bodies is probably, more likely in some cases. But anyway, I'll throw it back to you, Dick, for your comments in the jurisdiction.
Oh, I've got quite a few comments in what you just said, Gordon. I'm going to hold them, and then hear what Andy has to say first. Go ahead, Andy, KQLIW.
Okay, Dick, thank you, and I got to leave the car anyway, so can't stay in too long. Interesting subject. This could be a crazy question. Some people may say, what? But it's just a thought, so I'm going to just throw it out there. We know that sound does not travel in a vacuum. There is no sound in space, because there's no air. My question is, and it was just out of curiosity, if we could hear the sun in human hearing range, the way our ears work, and if sound were able to travel, the very basic question is, how loud would the sun be? I'm sure we would hear it, but how, maybe in decibel level, how loud would it be? And if there's no real answer, I'm sure scientists have been working on, or have scientists been working on finding out that this question, or this answer to this question. That's it, Dick. It's been a long day. Back to you.
WS2N. Paul recognized. We're going to get you in a minute, Paul. Solar helioseismology is the name of the science which literally measures the Doppler shift of various portions of the sun. The sun is ringing in many modes simultaneously like a huge bell. I'm convinced that if you could dip a high-temperature microphone into the solar material, into the chromosphere and down below, it is my belief you would hear the loudest roar possible, all possible acoustic frequencies from way subsonic to way ultrasonic and beyond. I think the sun is extremely loud because you could say, first of all, when a nuclear bomb goes off, is it loud? Wow, without a question. And what the sun is doing continuously is a zillion nuclear bombs going off each millisecond, so to speak. It's got to be loud. So can you harvest that sound? If you could just harvest the sound and convert it into electrical power, we wouldn't need oil anymore, so to speak. Go ahead, Paul. I'm sure you got comments on all of the above. WS2N, T2LIW.
Okay, Dick, there was a good show on, it was a series on the History Channel called Universe, and they ran through about, I guess, a dozen different shows, and I'm sure they'll show them again on that as a repeat. If you ever catch the one on the sun, you got to watch that one. That was very good. They said if you ever went in near the sun, it would be a very loud place. You know, it would be like putting a loudspeaker on the earth. Every spot you could find on the earth, you cover this whole place with a loudspeaker, and you add them all up, and that would be nothing compared to what you would hear on the sun. In fact, they believe they have found the cause of the degree temperature in the corona. You know, with any fire or flame, as they describe it in the show, you have the inverse square law. You know, it's hottest in the middle, and they take different temperatures as you go further out, and you know, by the time you get 4 feet away, your regular ambient temperature. If you had a fire, well, the same thing with the sun. The center is so very hot with this nuclear fusion that's going on. And the further out you get, it starts to cool off a little bit. But all of a sudden, you get to the corona sphere, and the guy says it would be like having this fire here at the beach and having it cool off. And then behind me, about 10 feet away, you'd have this high couple thousand degree temperature. It would be the equivalent of that. How could that be going on? They think the sound is so loud that the sound waves are going up and hitting the coronosphere and creating heat that way, just in the sound waves itself. A lot of the sound waves bounce back, and they hit the sun, and they show sunquakes, gigantic tidal waves, and that they create like tsunamis going completely around the sun. And they show these waves, you know. It hits and it completely circles the sun and just keeps on going. That's how loud these sound waves are supposed to be. They're very, very loud. Thank you.
I believe it. There was a science report 10, 15 years ago about subjecting
small number of laboratory white mice to extremely intense sound. This is not to damage their hearing, just to find out what other body effects. I think they had put earplugs on the poor mice while they did this, but while the mice were being subjected to very high sound intensity, the sound being absorbed by their fur and skin was creating excess heating, and the heating was putting the mice under a very significant stress, and I think it was lethal, as I remember. So it's hard to believe that sound in sufficient volume is a source of energy, not too different from a light bulb, a heat source, a flame, or whatever. It's an energy source. Whether you have a very strong radio wave inside your microwave oven that cooks your food, in theory, you could make an ultrasonic oven that with very intense sound waves that cooks your food. In theory, you could do that. And maybe there's a product there to be investigated. But now, Gordon, to answer your original question, to send a robot out there, bring it down, repair it, and send it back, sounds good. One of the puzzles that I give to the scientifically oriented people I work with, and I'm going to give it to you one right now, and I'm not going to really ask you the question. I'm going to speed up the process by telling you the answer. But the puzzle would be, if you and I were face-to-face and I felt like challenging you in a scientific manner, as many of these guys in Bergenfield, by the way, the most significant group of high-power, electrical engine motored radio control aircraft, one of the significant groups is in Bergenfield, New Jersey. You may or may not know about them. The Bergenfield Silent Flyers, another whole subject. Anyhow, make believe now that the BE satellite launching company, your company, accepted a contract to put a satellite in a geosynchronous orbit around the equator. And you launch the satellite, you put it into orbit, and you break open the champagne bottle, and everything's great. And so you're about to be paid for satisfying this contract. And all of a sudden, the secretary runs in and says, whoa, wait a minute, fellas. You launched that satellite around the equator. That contract was a polar orbit. It's supposed to be at the same altitude, but it's supposed to go over the North and South Pole. And to which your scientists will say, well, we'll just steer it from going around the equator to going around the pole. We'll just use the reaction control jet. Sounds good. And the next question I ask is, assuming it took one unit of energy to launch your satellite and to get it going around the equator at the geosynchronous altitude, how much energy would it take to correct the orbit? And the answer is 2 units of energy. Every bit of the energy going around the equator is in the wrong plane, in the wrong direction. You have to first use 1 unit of energy to stop all of that velocity in the equatorial direction. Then you use another unit of energy to create the velocity in the polar orbit. Space orbits behave very differently than expected. So here we have the James Webb Space Telescope out there a million miles, which expended a tremendous amount of energy to get it out there. Believe it or not, we don't just say, whoa, I feel like dropping it back down. It takes the exact same amount of energy with rocket power to be expended to bring it back. I'm not kidding. So all of those pre-stage rockets that gave you the energy to launch it and put it out there, by some magic, you have to get a rocket out there of that size. How you do that is a good trick. But you get a rocket out there of that size, and now you do the whole process in reverse to bring it back. And after you repair it, you bring up another rocket of that size to push it back out there. I think you see what's going on here, Gordon. For economic reasons and just pure energy requirements, again, I think it's very unlikely. You've used some good common sense, but when you dig into the particulars, unfortunately, it's a little bit worse than you thought. W2, Triple Tango, KQRIW.
I think I misspoke a bit. No, I mean, I wasn't suggesting bringing it back down to Earth. I was thinking of bringing it back into orbit, giving you less of an issue, because moving it in space from orbit A to orbit B, while it's a huge effort, would still leave it in orbit. You would have to overcome, you know, the really nasty, what I call near-field gravitational effects of Earth.
just some of the second and higher order effects. Would that be less onerous?
Yes, a little bit, but not enough. If you've seen an Apogee kick motor that you put on a geosynchronous satellite, which kicks it from the parking orbit up to the geosynchronous orbit, it's a significant rocket motor. Even getting one of those on board, and by the way, we're just talking about geosynchronous orbit now, which is 23,000 miles. That's a small fraction compared to the million miles of this Lagrange point. For a whole bunch of reasons, upkeep repair is out of the question. I will admit that a significant portion of the launch energy is getting it through the atmosphere the first time and getting into parking orbit. But there's still a tremendous energy required to get it further out. You and I have the ability to calculate that. In the electrical engineering course you probably have taken, you know how to take a point charge and move it from the vicinity of one other point charge and move it from there out to infinity. And so if you start a little bit further out before you move it to infinity, there's a different energy requirement. That's all calculatable. And so whether you're talking about the inverse square law of electrostatic attraction or electrostatic repulsion, or if you're talking about the inverse square law of gravity, there's a strong similarity between those two. So if you know how to calculate one, and for your electrical engineering course, you and I were forced to do that, you probably can calculate the other. And it's still a pretty big chunk. Also, when you bring it down, let me think now, from the Lagrange point to get it into orbit, and to get it into a circular orbit, you'd be amazed how difficult that is. It's called the Holloman maneuver that allows you to get from parking orbit into synchronous orbit. It's not just one push. One push will get you into a highly elliptical orbit. It takes a minimum of two blasts, carefully timed at the right portion of the orbit to circularize the orbit. To start off now with something at a very high orbit and bring it down to a circular orbit where your space shuttle can get there. Your space shuttle is not going to go into a highly elliptical orbit for a whole bunch of reasons. And to make the space shuttle orbit coplanar with the orbit you're going to reestablish when you bring it back down, that's not easy. One of the other things to worry about is that the most energy intensive requirement for space flight is to change orbital inclination. The space shuttle has the ability to burn all of its energy and get up to 600 nautical miles. If your space shuttle is at 140 nautical miles, and one of the lowest orbits you'll ever put it into, where it's just touching the top of the atmosphere, and you do a burn every 24 hours to reestablish that orbit, that's the flight that they often fly when they're not going to the space station, to tilt that orbit 3 degrees requires every bit of energy you get on board. Tilting the orbit is very difficult. So, as you can see, there's a fair amount of complication in the process. I won't say impossible, but I doubt rather highly they're planning on that. To send the repair mission, which is a much smaller mass, out there, as opposed to bring the very large mass. I mean, you look at the weight of a Hubble. It is huge. It used every bit of launch capability of the space shuttle in order to get Hubble into orbit. Hubble was the space shuttle, and the size of the hole, cargo hole of the space shuttle was designed specifically for the Hubble Space Telescope. The two of them are a married design test that was done quite some number of years ago, I guess way back in the early 80s. And so the James Webb Space Telescope, by definition, will be multiple times the mass of Hubble. And the mass of Hubble, I wish I knew the number, it's huge. There's a slim chance that Paul knows the number. Hey, Paul, roughly how heavy is Hubble? WS2N, KQRIW?
I forgot how many tons, but, you know, that mirror is glass. It's a heavy thing. That big, heavy thing that was made in Connecticut. Wow. It escapes me. We'll find it on the net or one of my magazines somewhere. Dick, and as far as going out there in the space shuttle in 2013, 2019, that's not going to be doable because we're going to need a time machine because the space shuttle is going to be done away with in 2010. So that means you have to redesign everything. The crew vehicle that they're building is essentially that. You'll have to build some kind of a platform to capture this space telescope, even if you could do it. You know what they do with that Hubble. They grab it, they put it into the bay of the space shuttle, and they're able to work on this thing. You know, what are you going to do in the future without that? Not doable. This has to work first time out there. Maybe they should build two in case one fails. They can put another one up back there.
Comment that K2KY.
Mel recognized, and a quick break though, Paul. Has anyone estimated the number of dollars required for the James Webb? Go ahead, Paul.
I read it. I don't remember, Dick. Sorry. And but that 14 diameter number is. You'll hear me talk about it. All the different things that go up, all the boosters and rockets, the truss segments for the International Space Station, and it's always 14 by 14 or 14 in diameter and everything. Because that's the size of the cargo bay, you're right, that whole thing is designed around the Hubble factory.
Isn't that amazing? 14 feet is also the dimension of a typical trailer, home trailer?
Yes, probably close to the size of a bus also. I think Hubble is in the vicinity of the size of a school bus. A really massive piece of hardware. And it might be heavier than a school bus. If someone told me it's heavier than a school bus, I would believe it. Mel, WS, here we go. K2KY, go right ahead. Humor, quick.
You got all the information about the Hubble. I'm just looking here. The mass is 11.4 tons. The length is 43 feet. And 14 feet in diameter. The primary mirror is 8 feet. Secondary mirror is a foot. The wavelength range, 110 nanometers to 1 millimeter IR. Angular resolution, they got this, the magnitude of the orbit, 380 miles at 28.5 degrees from the equator. Orbital period is 94 minutes, and it was planned to live 15 years.
And far outlived that. The difference in area between James Webb and Hubble is almost 7 to 1, 6.89 to 1. So it's going to be 7 times more light gathering power, 2 or 3 times more angular resolution, not counting the improvements that are going to be made in the optics and so on. Who is it that want to make a further comment?
This is Gordon, WTCTC.
Go ahead, Gordon.
I just remember 14 feet being non-standard because my family used to be in the carpet manufacturing business, and they made a ton of money actually sustaining what I'll call archaic manufacturing processes for other products. For a decade by making 14-foot wide carpet for trailers for the, you know, custom, should we say, trailer industry, because normal carpet was either 12 or 15 feet, which was exceptionally wide, or 9, so that but normally 12 and occasionally 15, but 14 was actually required special tooling to make, and that's what the industry requires, and you make a lot of money doing it. So I'm wondering if somebody thought of 14 feet. I'd love to know the genesis of 14 feet. Kind of like, you know, railroad gauges are really based on Roman roads.
Yeah, the real origin things at times are strange as all hell. Somebody establishes a cockamamie standard. Everyone's afraid to change it, and we stick with that standard forever, even though it sometimes has some huge disadvantages. Is that sort of what you're saying, Gordon?
That's kind of where I'm wondering, yeah. But I do know that I think standard railroad gauges here in this country are based on, or maybe it's Europe, I can't remember now, are based on the width of a Roman road and based on a Roman military cart or something.
It might even be a chariot. I think someone told me once that narrow gauge track that's used in South American countries was based on the width of a chariot. I'm not sure. But strange origins. So, Yeah, it's great fun to talk about.
I think that's where we're going here. But anyway, I'd like to know the origin of the 14-foot rule, as it were. The seeming rule, anyway. WCTV, we'll go on to the other subjects now.
Yeah, I'm sure for the time being it has something to do with the technology available to build segmented mirrors with automatic tuning techniques. Right now, the biggest fully steerable telescope, is it called the Webb? No, I don't know what it's called, but it's a, at one time it was called the GBT, Green Bank Telescope, a great big telescope, 100 meters in diameter. I visited the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia, and I saw that telescope under construction. It is approximately a 1 acre, a little shy of 1 acre of area of telescope that under normal circumstances would have to use very high technology to be usable, having enough surface accuracy up to, say, 2 gigahertz. By way of it being made out of 2,600 individual panels, where each individual panel at the four corners has jack screws. And the jack screws are run by a computer, but the four corners of each panel is a corner cube, a retro-reflecting corner cube, and at the main focal point there is a laser finding interferometry system that looks at the shape and distance, so to speak, of every one of the 2,600 panels, scans them all very rapidly, and so as a function of temperature, gravity, wind load, whatever, these gear motors tune themselves to keep correcting the surface accuracy of that telescope. Very ingenious design. So instead of the telescope being usable to 2,000 megapixels maximum, it's usable well beyond 100,000 megapixels, 100 gigahertz and beyond. So when you go up that high, you start seeing things you never thought you were going to see. For instance, they've already discovered a significant number of molecules of organic material, organic molecules, floating free in space. I looked for their particular emission lines. That would suggest that biological life as we know it will happen automatically every time you do the experiment. All you have to do is wait long enough for it to become intelligent life. That's a philosophy, and you could support that point of view without too much difficulty with what we now know from my point of view. I think it's only a matter of time before we truly develop, discover exobiology. Something like 160 stars are now known to have planetary systems, and you count all the planets going around those stars, we're up to something like 230 exoplanets. In the past, we were only discovering the ones that were Jupiter-sized at a Mercury distance, and the only reason why we could only discover those is because we're looking for the wobble of the sun created by the planet going around it. And so the limited sensitivity of that detecting system means you can only find the big enclosed planet at first. And as the sensitivity of those systems increases, we're starting to find smaller and smaller planets further and further out. They're there. We just couldn't detect them because of the method that we're using. So we're now approaching the threshold of finding planets in the Goldilocks zone. That really means a planet like planet Earth is in the magic zone, not too close, not too far, where hydrocarbon life, water-based life can easily be formed. Just a matter of time. So exobiology, life off of this Earth, it's just a matter of time, not a very large amount of time, in which that will be discovered. Now, are we going to find extraterrestrial intelligence in the near future? That's a much more difficult question. But I'm convinced that we will find exobiological life. Now, we may even find it within our own solar system. There are some very spiritual-minded people that are going to be quite troubled by that when it happens. There are other people who are not going to be troubled by it. There's lots to discuss on that whole subject. I know we're a little bit far off the usual ham radio subject. Now to bring us back down to Earth, for real things like transmission lines, antennas, and Smith charts and whatever, Mel's probably going to dip into his mailbag, and or he's going to tell us what new breakthroughs are being proposed that were being mentioned at the Kings County Radio Club picnic today. K2KEY, K2RIW.
W2IGH.
I guess we're going to give Hugo a Hugo wanted to say a few words. We'll give you some time. Go ahead, Hugo.
I'll try and make this very quickly. First of all, I agree with you on the that we probably are surrounded with other universes. That was always my opinion. But you were talking just now about life. There is it's not a theory, actually. It's what they think is that one of the moons, Europa, I think it is, around Jupiter, could have some life on it, because they see some, at least they believe from visual observation, basically, I think by the Hubble spacecraft, that there is some sheet of water under the surface. In other words, there is
on the moon or Earth
surface, and I think they're making preparations to send something to that, or eventually, I don't know if it's only in the planning stage, but I've seen a device where they want to send it there and then bore into the crust and get into that water and see if there's life underneath, because apparently there's some internal warming in that moon that is around Jupiter, Europa, I think, does have, warm. Of course, if there's water, that there may be some life. That's not intelligent life, of course, but just very primitive life. So back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Hugo, you're reconfirming something I believe, and that is that we amateurs have a lot of interest in astronomy and what astronomy is, some of the really far-reaching questions astronomy is trying to answer. Those four major so-called Galilean moons going around Jupiter, four great big moons, that the very first thing that anybody who gets a telescope usually looks at is either Saturn or Jupiter. Those four moons of Jupiter were first reviewed with a telescope by good old Galileo Galilei I think it was 1612. And boy, did that create a lot of problems, because he suddenly realized when he watched those moons going around Jupiter, whoa, the Earth ain't the center of this universe. There are other things going around, other things. And then he started seeing sunspots. The sun wasn't perfect. And with the church, he got himself in trouble. He was under house arrest. But Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto were those four moons. And I think it's Europa, the second one, has an ice crust. But because it is so close to Jupiter and is continuously being gravity rocked, you could say, by Jupiter, they believe there is internal heating going on, and there appears to be water on the surface. And so where you have liquid water below the frozen surface, there's a good probability life is there. When you study planet Earth, it is extremely difficult to find a environment that is so severe where there is no life. You dig into the ice of the Antarctic, and you will find microbial life. You dig into the water that's under the ice, in the Arctic or the Antarctic, and you'll find microbial life and other kinds of life. It's very, very difficult to find a place. You go to these hot geyser-like things that are below the surface of the ocean, and you find life there that doesn't require sunlight. It doesn't require photosynthesis. It works by another chemical reaction, but it is a kind of living, reproducible, plant animal-like thing that lives there. The only place on planet Earth that has ever been found to be free of any kind of life that has been discovered so far is the Paranal Plain in the Andes Mountains of Chile. And that's where my buddy Banford works periodically. I mean, when you get a tenth of an inch of rain per decade, is that place dry? Wow. That powdery, dry sand you have in that Paranal Plain is the one place where you scoop up some of the soil, put it into a petri dish with the right kind of a medium, and nothing grows. I don't think they have found any other place on planet Earth that is free of life. So, with rare exception, when you have the right conditions, it appears as though life will form every time. So, there are some pretty forward-thinking people thinking that the moon of Jupiter called Europa could very well have life, and so on the planning board, if I understand correctly, there are spacecraft right now that are eventually going to go there and investigate that. Because once again, once we find any biological life, no matter how simple, I don't care if it's one cellular life or if it's a very complicated plant or animal, once we find